This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Robert Morley, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet Magazine and today's host for Trumpet Hour. Joel Hilliker is out of town, so there's some pretty big shoes to fill, but we'll do our best for you today. Thank you for listening. We have a great program for you. Let me begin by introducing our panel. These gentlemen make up our editorial and news bureau staff at the Philadelphia Trumpet Magazine and the trumpet.com website. And gentlemen, if you wouldn't mind giving us a brief description of the news item that you brought for us today, that would be great too. I have here in the studio with me Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be with you today. I'll be talking about the people of Russia and how a majority of them say that they would welcome a revival of the old Soviet Union.
And we also have Andrew Miller.
Great to be here. Today we'll be talking about political revolution in the United States and the looming risk that the U.S. government may declare insolvency in the near future.
Insolvency. Wow. Okay. Big topic. We also have Brent Noctegal joining us today from Edstone, England.
Hello. I'd like to talk about a little bit later how Western media has painted the Palestinian struggle against the Israelis as a fight of the poor against the much more rich. And yet, with the attack this week, we can see that that isn't always the case.
Thank you for that, Brent. And also over there in Edstone at our European office, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon. The EU is continuing to move into Africa. They're getting ready to move their navy into Libyan waters, and Germany is sending hundreds of soldiers into northern Mali.
Thank you for that, gentlemen. Let's go ahead and begin with our top story this week. This week's top story has to do with everybody's favorite grandfatherly figure, presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. This past week, he lost the Democrat primary in New York, but that doesn't mean he is going away or that he hasn't impacted America in big ways. So here to tell us more about Mr. Sanders is Andrew Miller.
Yes, well, as you said, this past Tuesday, they had another primary in New York, and presidential candidate Hillary Clinton did much better than Senator Sanders in the primary. So it's pundits are starting to say it's this looks like it might be it for him. It's not impossible for him to still clinch the U.S. nomination, but it's getting more and more unlikely. But we have an article in our Trumpet Weekly this week just really revealing that whether he gets the nomination or not at this point is really a moot point. He has, in many ways, already won this socialist revolution he keeps talking about in the campaigns.
So he's losing the vote, but he's winning the ideological wars.
Right. It's amazing. I'm working on an article, hopefully, to have up in another week or so, kind of on the Sanders revolution. And it just it really starts out. They said back in 1996, Barack Obama, this was before he was a senator, he signed a contract in Chicago promising that he'd support an organization called the New Party, which was a socialist organization, very hostile to what they considered the more centralist platform of Bill and Hillary Clinton, and extremely hostile to American capitalism. Now, this fact came out in the 2008 campaign, and the Obama campaign at the time did some major backpedaling. I mean, they're saying that this isn't true, this is all lies, this is smears. And I mean, a couple years after the campaign, they actually found the contract at the Wisconsin Historical Society with his name on it. So it's kind of hard to deny now. But it just shows that even as recently as 8 years ago, they knew that if you would have been labeled as a socialist in an American presidential campaign, that was like the kiss of death. You'd have been dead in the water.
But times are changing.
8 years now, I mean, Bernie Sanders, I mean, he's very proud that he says he's a democratic socialist. I mean, I won't go through the whole list here, but he's associated himself not with the New Party, but with other third parties, even more radical. I guess, well, I'll mention one. But in 1972, he backed the People's Party, which is actually most famous for calling for a legal maximum income of $55,000 a year. It would be illegal.
Maximum income.
You can't earn more than $55,000. That would be the government set maximum.
So what happens if you earn more than $55,000?
Right, you get a pay cut.
You get a pay cut. Somebody else takes the rest of the money that you would earn.
Right. This was a a big campaign promise in 1972, which he was very for at the time.
Now, why would people be for that?
Right. Well, I think there was a minimum income of $6,000 as well. So if you're saying, well, if we tax anything above $55,000, you've got all this money apparently that you can just give to people below the poverty line.
Right.
And I mean, that party didn't go anywhere back, especially 1972. Again, kiss of death to espouse that. But now, I mean, in the Iowa caucuses, they said about 83% of Democrats under the age of 30 had supported Sanders. Not enough to give him the nomination, because a lot of the older Democrats are still supporting Hillary Clinton, but that's what this point in the
Trump... That is astounding. 83%.
Of those under 30.
Of those under 30. That's the young people. That's our next generation.
That's what I'm saying, is a lot of these new 18-year-old voters, I mean, they were 10 last time when Obama was first elected, but they've grown up under the Obama administration. They've embraced a lot of these socialist ideals, and now it's to the point where really whether Sanders wins or not is a moot point, because give it 10 years and this is our next generation of political leaders.
That's the direction that we're heading right. In America. When you look at the young demographic, I find this just fascinating, because you know, I'll ask you, has socialism ever worked anywhere? Like, we see all these young people that are embracing it. And I just wonder, maybe you can even talk about that a little bit. Is socialist, socialism really have a track record of bringing prosperity to all?
Right. I mean, it, obviously, at the end, it's more extreme forms, the like the communist or the actual really democratic socialist nations of the world. They've all been just basket cases. I mean, Sanders tries to tout Scandinavia, like Denmark, Sweden, Norway, more as his model, although those nations aren't nearly as nice a places to live in as he makes it sound like, and in a lot of ways aren't really socialist. They're still, I mean, they don't own the means of production. They're still capitalist nations with just a really, really huge bureaucracy, really, really progressive income tax. But
And some of them, like Norway, have a lot of oil resources.
Got natural resources that help them out somewhat. And even then, I mean, there's a lot of things that happen in countries like that would be shocking to American mindset. I just read another case, which is actually quite common over there, of the government stepping in and taking like 3 children away from their Christian parents because they spanked them occasionally. No trial, no federal judge, just a bureaucratic agency can take that, which is, that'd make front page headlines in America. But in Europe, I don't think that gets much of a rise anymore.
That's just crazy. And Andrew, why is it that you think so many people are embracing socialism, so many young people in America? What is behind this?
In a large part, it's the education system. It's actually funny. I have a few statistics here where they said that I gave the 83% statistic earlier. That was just Democrat supporters. But nationwide, they say it's probably more like 43% of those under 30 support socialism. But though interesting, only 16% could actually define it as government ownership of the means of production.
Yeah, I think that is pretty emblematic of what we see at a lot of universities today. We see, students very excited about, these big ideals, but when you actually push them on, what does it actually mean? When you get down to the specifics, like, what is this going to mean?
Right.
It's all very vague, and people have a general understanding what something is, but I don't think a lot of people understand what it actually means.
I think I'd seen an interview with one young Sanders supporter where they're trying to get him to like define socialism. It's like, it's like socialism. It's being kind and it's being together and it's helping people out. And they had throw in a few more statistics. They had another one where they had that 43% said they supported socialism. But of the same exact same study group and the exact same survey, only 32% said they supported a government-managed economy, which means there's about 10% of the people in that 100 had no idea that
So they're getting caught up in the Bernie Sanders, bandwagon and the excitement at all the universities and all these.
Right. They hear him talking about the big banks have all the money and they're not letting us have any. So we need to break them up. And
but it does have very real impact. If America were to elect a Bernie Sanders, I mean, he knows what he stands for. He knows what he wants to do to America. So these young people, I don't think really realize what they're asking for. Andrew, just before I let you go here, going forward, what kind of impacts do you see for America, just this trend of socialism being brought into the mainstream?
Well, it's, like I said, regardless of who wins the presidential nomination, I think it's definitely going to be said that the political scene in America is going to drift further left. I mentioned earlier about Barack Obama supporting the New Party, in large part against the more centralist platform of the Clintons. That's not true anymore because of the whole Sanders revolution. Hillary Clinton found out very early on that she has to track further left if she's going to try to tap into that support base. So
right, and we're seeing that
the whole political spectrum is having to go further and further left, further and further towards socialism, because that's where the people are going.
Right, right. Okay, well, thank you very much for that report, Andrew. This is 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma, or kpcg.fm online. We have been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about the revival of socialism in America. Socialism used to be a dirty word, but recent polls, as Andrew mentioned, have shown that more than half of young people, or around half of young people, say they prefer it to capitalism. And this is not a trend that will be going away anytime soon. So grab your wallets, hang on to them tightly. Socialism's great until some government bureaucrat decides it's time to share, quote unquote, your wealth with others. Okay, next up, I'd like to talk with Jeremiah, because Jeremiah, you have a story that on the surface might seem to contradict what Andrew was talking about, what Andrew and I were just saying, because America isn't the only country that's having a socialist revival. And we're seeing in a country that once rejected a lot of those socialist principles. Would you go ahead and just tell us what you have for us today?
Yeah, sure. Here we are just about a quarter of a century after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And Russians, for the most part, now say that they would welcome the resurrection of that old dictatorial Soviet system, the socialist system. A poll was published this week by the Levada Center, based there in Moscow. They surveyed 1,600 Russians from all across the country. 48 different Russian regions were represented. And the conclusion is that 58% of them would welcome the revival of the Soviet Union. Only about 31% of them said they would not want it rebuilt. So that leaves about 11% who are undecided or somewhere in between.
Okay, I'm really hoping you can help me reconcile these positions here. Here we have Russia, a socialist, communist country, or used to be under the Soviet Union. It collapses, it falls apart. We see all these pictures of, you know, people waiting in these massive bread lines. You know, they go to the stores and they get one or two, you know, instead of in America where you have 15 boxes of cereal to choose from, you have two, you know, state option one, state option two. And then the whole system comes tumbling down. They embrace capitalism, or at least a form of capitalism. And now here we are, you know, more than a decade later, getting close to three decades later. And we see the people of Russia saying, actually, the Soviet Union, those old days, weren't so bad after all. Maybe there are some things that we actually like about that.
Yeah, I think a lot of what's behind this is perhaps less about economics than it is about being perceived as a superpower. They miss the glory days when the Soviet Union or Russia was one of two global superpowers, just commanded immense respect and power on the international stage. And it seems like that's mostly what the Russians would welcome a return of. And if you dig into the stats and demographics a little bit, you'll see something that parallels what Andrew was talking about, and that is that it's mostly the younger generation that are those who are most in favor of resurrecting the corpse of that old Soviet Union. Those who are aged 20 to 35 had the highest rates of approval for the Soviet system. Most of those were not even alive when it collapsed, or they were little children when it collapsed. But they've been fed a lot of stories by Vladimir Putin's media empire about the old glory days, and you know, when we were feared, we were commanded, or we were really respected. We had great lives, and those who didn't live through it are much more prone to believe that.
Yeah, I think one big global trend is it almost seems like Russia, China, and America, at least from an economic perspective, are all kind of meeting in the middle as far as their economic model, because back in Soviet Union times, the Soviet Union collapsed because their doctrinaire Marxist-Leninism didn't work right well. So China caught on to that a little early, and I guess they call it state capitalism now, where it's still a state-run socialist government, but with a lot more private ownership and capitalistic reforms that made it more effective. I believe Putin's already sent advisors to China to try to learn from what they did to figure, like, okay, well, we need to alter our socialist model to include more private ownership so we can be as economically prosperous as China. And then America's coming at it from the other way. They're coming from the real free market, libertarian capitalist model, but then instituting more socialist reforms where more and more the economic system of Russia, China, and America are about half and half socialist, half capitalist. They almost seems like they're meeting in the middle from the old Cold War days.
Yeah. This is just a really interesting trend. It's we have young people everywhere around this world that are rejecting the current systems. You know, whether we're looking at Russia and we're seeing the young people over there saying, hey, this isn't working. We want something different. In America with the Sanders phenomenon, even with Trump, we see it with a lot of his supporters as well, although his demographic tends to be a little older, I think, the stirred up demographic. But why is that? Richard, you have your hand up. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that this kind of touches on a really interesting point, that we're witnessing the end of ideology. Ideology really shapes the 20th century. And, you know, you had the big clash of Nazism and fascism that really gained a huge following, not just in Europe, even in America. You had Henry Ford and people like that. And there seemed to be this genuine idea that fascism could be the way forward. Then you had this big clash of capitalism versus communism. And now neither nation are really ideologically committed to either system. They just want whatever works. And so then that raises the question, is there a void there? What's going to fill the void? And maybe Russia kind of points us to the answer, where they've really revived the Russian Orthodox Church. And could you see we swung from the Enlightenment, from religion to ideology, and we saw a lot of that in the French Revolution as well, and even the 19th century. And could the pendulum now be swinging back, as we see in the Middle East, as we see in Russia, to religion?
I think that's a great point. It makes me wonder if we'll see something like that, or how soon we'll see something like that in Europe. I mean, especially with the Francis phenomenon, it seems like he is really working hard to repopularize religion with young people, and it seems like he's having some success there.
Yeah, I agree. And I think Europe's in an interesting position because ideology, in a way, died with the Nazis a long time ago in Europe. In that sense, I'd say perhaps it's been replaced by multiculturalism as their kind of ideology, or this liberal tolerance. That's being killed off by the migrant crisis, and so that could really then hasten the search for an alternative.
Yeah, I agree with you, and it seems like, since we're on this topic of Europe here, when we see a continent being invaded by people of another religion, it makes me wonder what that backlash will be of the native Europeans, and if it will be if how quick there will be a backlash towards Europe's cultural roots. I think that's something that we really need to be watching in Europe, and we'll probably talk a little bit more about that in the show later on. Jeremiah, thank you very much for that report. I know you'll be watching developments over there closely. Prophecy is coming alive in Russia in very dramatic ways. Next up, I'd like to talk a little bit about Africa. This is a region that a lot of people don't think a lot about unless we're hearing about, you know, famine or some sort of kidnapping tragedy. I'm thinking of the Bring Back Our Girls hashtag, where, you know, hundreds of girls dozens of girls were kidnapped from a village and sold into slavery. Richard, it appears that North Africa, at least, has gotten the attention of Europe. Tell us, what's going on with that today?
That's right. In terms of the most immediate news, this week the EU and the EU foreign minister Federica Mogherini had some important talks with the kind of provisional Libyan government that is in control of at least part of the country. They're preparing the way to step up on security cooperation. They're saying they're going to help the new Libyan government with things like border control, migration control, and policing. And then they're also raising the possibility now of moving their naval patrols in the Mediterranean into Libyan waters to start to try and attack smuggling gangs. So that's the more immediate news. To give a slightly broader picture, there's a convergence of two big crises for Europe really affect North Africa. Terrorism is rising in North Africa. Mali is becoming still increasingly dangerous. We've seen fairly major attacks there in recent months. At the same time, the focus of the migrant crisis is shifting. Those nations north of Greece have kind of sealed off Greece's borders. And so now Europe is expecting many more migrants to start to try and make the crossing from Libya into Italy, and that this could become the focus of the migrant crisis potentially in 2016. And so for these two reasons, Europe is really focusing on Africa.
Okay. Hey, Richard, we're seeing a lot of talk about this migrant crisis. And, you know, as you mentioned, there's a humanitarian angle to it. But just for our listeners, How much, in your estimation, how much are we seeing Europe's involvement being driven by humanitarian reasons versus bigger picture geopolitical strategic type concerns?
Oh, definitely just bigger picture strategic rather than humanitarian. I've got an article here. I don't think this one quite made it into the Trumpet Weekly, but it's called It's a Good Time to Be a Dictator Again, From War is Boring. And it's talking about the fact that Europe, having kind of sworn off working with these dictators for humanitarian reasons, are forming these underhand agreements with a whole host of very unsavory regimes in Africa. You know, places like Sudan, Eritrea, Ethiopia, Somalia, and you know, these places are in real problems with their human rights records, really authoritarian regimes, and they're coming up with arrangements to send refugees back to their countries, in some cases where they would face torture. And there was a leak where they had a secret or closed-door meeting with the European Commission, and they said the Commission emphasizes the sensibility of the contents, which can't be allowed to be made public under any circumstances. So they're away from the eye of the public that are keen on all these humanitarian efforts. They're trying to deal with the migrant crisis in a much more kind of cynical realpolitik way.
Yeah. And Brent, I'd like to bring you to the discussion here a little bit too. I think a lot of Americans just view Africa and the Middle East as just a mess, and that it's not worth the hassle or the effort to be involved over there, and that we should just, you know, get out of there, leave it to itself, leave the North Africans to themselves, the Arabs to themselves. But the Middle East really is a strategic piece of real estate. I mean, there is value to it, and there are very specific reasons that Europeans are concerned with this area. I know you're working on a piece for the next upcoming print edition of The Trumpet. Perhaps you could talk a little bit more about the strategic nature of the Mediterranean.
Throughout history, obviously, it's been extremely important to maintain control of the Mediterranean, which has Europe to its north, and then the coast of Syria, Lebanon, Israel to its west, and then the North African coast as well. I mean, it's not huge. The distance from one side to the other is pretty important. And trade from the Indian Ocean, especially for the British, from India, and even before then, for the Dutch, down into the Spice Islands, down Indonesia, in Indonesia, have used at least the sea route through the Red Sea. And then even before they had the Suez Canal, they used to put everything on camel caravans and then have boats on the other side at Port Said and near Alexandria and take the goods from there up into Europe. So it's been critical throughout history to control especially the North African region, because if any trade is to get to Europe, a lot of the trade is going to come through there. And that's only increased with the construction of the Suez Canal and with the dependence that now exists in the past 50, 60 years on oil coming out of the Middle East as well. So the Europeans, they obviously see that there is a need to stabilize North Africa to ensure at least free transit of goods, because that can be turned into a political tool or a political weapon by nations in Africa if they choose to use it. And Europe has been really, they've had a concerted effort throughout the past 100 years to control, especially Egypt, just because of that reason. And what we see in Libya, what we see in Egypt, and even in Algeria, and all those nations across North Africa, we see them turning into a more Islamic powerhouse, like jihadis that don't like Europe at all, and that would like to do anything they can to disrupt that.
So it sounds like to me you're saying that as America continues to pull out from the Middle East, we should be... going forward, we should expect to see a lot more attention given by Europe to this region.
Oh, I know Richard's jumping on the mic, trying to talk over here, but I'd be surprised if they didn't. And they have to. They've got no choice. They have to take care of themselves because America is pulling out. I think Richard might have something to add.
Yeah, well, yeah, and we see it already. I mean, we've getting to the point now. I think we're on at least 500. It's going to build up to close to 1,000 German troops in Mali, and this is, in terms of UN missions that they're involved in, this is by far the most dangerous. And in the past, you've seen German troops, like the big criticism in Afghanistan is that they avoided all the dangerous areas. So you are already seeing big ramp-ups of military troops. You've got thousands of French troops around the area. So you've got some pretty substantial movement in that direction already.
So how much?
And I think one more thing I'd like to add. I think it's a less politically charged region for Europe to step into as their gateway into, especially Germany, into greater military involvement in the world. I mean, they could have decided to go in militarily and stop things at the border with Turkey and in Syria, but they couldn't because they had to deal with Russia. They had to deal with Iran. As far as the world is concerned and other big players, including the United States, including Russia and Iran, they don't seem too preoccupied with North Africa. So it is the easier option for them to kind of intervene in this fight there.
Good points. Okay, Brent, Richard, we're out of time for this topic, but thank you very much for those contributions. For those of you joining us, you are listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review on kpcg.fm or 101.3 on the FM dial here in Edmond, Oklahoma. We've been talking about socialism in America. We've been talking about why so many Russians long for the days of the old Soviet Union and why Europe appears to be moving into North Africa and why they are putting so much effort on that region. All these articles are in this week's Trumpet Weekly, a very informative, high-quality report we produce each week. And that report contains what we feel is the most significant stories, the best commentary from the very best sources. So I'd like to encourage all of our listeners to subscribe to the Trumpet Weekly. It's a free weekly news report. Just go ahead and log on to thetrumpet.com and click on the subscribe tab and become a subscriber. We have a break coming up, but before I get to that, I would like to talk to Brent one more time. Brent, Iran's foreign minister had some very interesting words in an opinion piece he wrote in the Washington Post this week.
Yes, he certainly did, and he's provoked a bit of a backlash from Israel, especially because of some of his terminology. But if people remember the nuclear deal, just to understand who this man is, he was the guy that was smiling from Iran, their representative that was in most of the discussions with the United States and with Europe. And he was the face of a moderate Iran. And he was somebody that looked like he could be worked with. He went to college, I guess, or university in the United States. So he was seen as somebody that was probably a little bit more pro, warmer with, to have warm relations with America and the West rather than the Ayatollah, the bearded man. He only has a goatee, Zarif, so he can't be that bad. But he wrote an article this week which talks about how the world is upset with Iran for increasing their military buildup. And he says it's unjustified, basically, because it's for defensive purposes. And he even, the bit that got most people upset was the fact that he went back in history and talked about the Iran-Iraq war and how the United States or weapons that was given to that ended up falling into the hands of Saddam Hussein from the United States with their original source, whether they wanted them or not to get into Saddam's hands or not. That's another thing. But at the same time, just after the 1979 coup, where the Shah was booted, the United States put different restrictions and sanctions or different restrictions on the type of arms that could go to Iran. And because of that history, they feel slighted by the United States that they built up Iraq's arsenal, but did not allow Iran to defend themselves. So because of that, Zarif said that he said, quote, the words never again, end quote, resonate with Iranians too. Now, if I say never again, I'm betting that half of our audience at least, well, I'm hoping that half of our audience knows what that's talking about. Of course, it refers to the Holocaust that took place in Germany in World War II against the Jews and how the Jews have a saying of never again. That's never going to be allowed again to happen. And yet that is the precise terminology that Zarif puts in his article to say that we are never going to back down from the West and again in allowing us not to have apparently defensive weapons.
Yeah, and besides the fact that it's absolutely ridiculous to make a comparison between the two events, what happened in World War II with right. the Nazi Holocaust and then not allowing weapons. I mean, to me, this is just emblematic of how the regime has dealt with America since the very beginning of these nuclear negotiations. And to me, it just confirmed, I don't know what your take is, but to me, it just confirms that they really aren't interested in what America thinks they're interested in.
Right. And I feel like it's borderline, well, it is anti-Semitic to even write such a thing, to negate or to downplay or, yeah, to try and have a parallelism between 6 million Jews, defenseless, obviously, people completely defenseless to the point of, you know, all their weapons were taken away from them in the decade before, even like their personal use of weapons in Germany. And then to think that those Jews just being lined up for the gas chambers is equal with Iran today, which is known by the whole world to be the leading state sponsor of terrorism. It's known to promote wars. It's known to not just promote, but even instigate and start these wars with foreign powers. Now, he concluded this article talking about how for the past two centuries, Iran has never started a war with its military, like a military conflict between countries. And he's right. But look at the Middle East. He even goes to the point of lambasting Saudi Arabia, of course, because of their military buildup, and says that, hey, they can build up. Can't we build up? When Iran's buildup post-nuclear deal is the very precise reason that Saudi Arabia is trying to increase their defenses. One more thing I'd like to just get in here about this is that while he keeps on saying that we need our defensive edge in order to defend ourselves from Saudi Arabia, from these other nations, from the West, what are they putting their efforts into? They are having ballistic missile tests, intercontinental ballistic missiles. They had another one this week. And, you know, they're not for defensive purposes. They're not trying to, it's not like Israel's Iron Dome trying to shoot down rockets coming at them. No, the only reason you have an intercontinental ballistic missile is to put a nuclear warhead on it and to fire it a great distance. That is not defensive whatsoever.
So breaking news from Brent, Iran is not interested in giving up its nuclear arms. I think all of our listeners who've been listening to the Trumpet for any length of time understand that the nuclear deal with Iran was a very, very bad one. And Iran has no intention of giving up his pursuit of a weapon. Thank you very much for that, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour. You've been listening to on 101.3 on FM dial or KPCG.FM. It's time for a break, but we'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
This is Trumpet Hour with your host, Robert Morley, filling in to Joel Hilliker. We are back, and you are listening to our Week in Review program, looking at the big stories from around this world this past week. Let's now turn to China. Jeremiah, you have a pretty interesting piece about some clever activity by the Chinese government. Take us through what's going on.
Okay, sure. War is being waged in the South Pacific. Though it lacks the grisly kill zones of Iraq and Afghanistan, the quiet rolling slopes of New Zealand and the browned plains of Central Australia are pivotal battlefields. That's the start of the cover story in the Trumpet Weekly this week. It's called Bought Out, China's Attack on Agriculture. It was written by the Trumpet's Australian correspondent based in Brisbane there, Callum Wood. And it's a really powerful and sobering article. It shows that the agriculture sectors of both Australia and New Zealand really are being attacked by China through these insidious and aggressive and often underestimated and ignored trade policies. I'll read a quote from the article here. He says, "Being the largest trade partner of both countries, China has a crucial role to play in these Western economies. Chinese behavior has repeatedly led to devastating consequences for both Australia and New Zealand." From there, he goes on to talk about what's happening with New Zealand's dairy industry in particular. Dairy is enormous in New Zealand. It's the largest international producer of milk, and dairy actually makes up a staggering 25% of New Zealand's exports. But China's been waging this insidious war on this small country. In 2013, China bought a record 622,000 tons of milk from New Zealand, and it seemed like Chinese demand was set to stay steady or to possibly even grow beyond that. So, eager to cash in on China's desire for milk and baby formula and other dairy products, many nations, high on the list was New Zealand, they just planned as though that rush would continue. So the farmers and governments invested heavily in the dairy industry. Business boomed for a little while, particularly in those dairy-oriented economies of New Zealand and Australia. And everybody just thought that China would keep on buying it all up at premium prices. But then, very suddenly, China pulled out. Here's another quote from Callum's article that explains this. "All along, China was manipulating the commodity price. The Chinese were not using the baby formula and milk. They were stockpiling it. Beijing pulled the same tactics on Australia's mining industry back in 2013. China created an artificially high demand, built up stockpiles, and then pulled out of the market. So it's an incredible thing that happened there. And for New Zealand, the results have been disastrous. Just 2 years ago, milk prices were at $5.87 per kilogram, which is just over a quart for those of us who don't use those strange measurements. And today, they are at less than half that. It's $2.73 per kilogram.
So it's pushing them out of business.
Yeah.
And this is a policy... this is what Callum is arguing, is that this is a policy of the Chinese government.
Yeah, and it was carefully planned. And the farmers in New Zealand planned for those high prices to continue. They planned for the Chinese demand to hold steady, but they didn't realize that the Chinese were actually stockpiling it. So they really were hoodwinked by China.
So what happens? These farmers, they go bankrupt, and then what happens?
Yeah, it has devastated the industry. Dairy prices are down 60%. There is a significant percentage of farmers that are under serious mortgage pressure. Suicide rates for those in the farming communities is growing really rapidly. Right now, it's up to 50% higher than it is for people in urban areas. It's something that's just really devastated a lot of farms and communities.
So you can see the social toll. And then I imagine as these farms go bankrupt, they're under pressure. That's when we see the angle of China swooping in and buying up the assets on the cheap.
Yeah, that's right. Once they're in financial trouble, then they're eager to sell, and they'll sell for far less than what it would be worth in a healthy market.
Right, and now we're seeing something similar in Australia too, aren't we?
Yeah, that's right. In Australia, a Chinese company just bought the largest dairy farm. Australia is a huge country, but this farm it represented about 1% of Australia's total landmass, an enormous amount of land. It's bigger than Ireland.
1% of the continent of Australia.
That's right.
China bought 1% of the continent. It's
in the works. This deal is poised to go through. It's not yet official. But there have been all kinds of other similar acquisitions. In 2013, Chinese companies bought Australia's largest cotton farm. In 2014, China bought about 50 farms in Victoria. Over the past 5 years, a very large number of wineries and sugar farms have also fallen to Chinese investment. And so it's a pretty significant trend that's underway there.
So we see them bidding up the prices artificially, getting all kinds of malinvestment, farmers, Australians, New Zealanders to borrow all this money, and then they pull the rug out. And when they pull the rug out, then the government from China swoops in to pick up the pieces on the cheap. That's what's going on.
Yep, that's exactly right.
Okay, thanks for that, Jeremiah. Talking of China, let's go ahead and go over to throw the ball back in Richard's court here, because I know, Richard, China is on the move elsewhere in the world too. It's not just in Australia, not just in New Zealand, but it's making some inroads into Europe.
That's right. They are expanding their control of the port of Piraeus in Greece. Buying a port doesn't sound like much. It's a major, major investment that they're making here, close to $1 billion in this port alone in terms of purchase price and then the follow-up investment that they've promised. So we're seeing a major, major investment by China into Greece. But this is part as well of a much wider push from China. We've talked before, and Jeremiah's talked a bit on this program about their One Belt, One Road initiative and their New Silk Road initiative, where they're trying to build very strong transportation links with Europe. And they're really focusing a lot of this on Eastern Europe. Its economies are struggling. They tend to have much weaker infrastructure than Western Europe. And so they're making sure that they're helping them build things like ports, things like high-speed rail. They're working with Serbia and Hungary on that. And then they're making sure that when this infrastructure is built, it helps link these countries in to China. And it's had a really big impact. You know, trade with Eastern Europe has increased by trade between Eastern Europe and China has increased by 50% since 2011. So that's a major increase. And this initiative is only just getting started.
So let me just throw this out there then. Richard, Europe is known for its protectionist measures. You know, we hear a lot of times complaints out of the UK, you know, France is protecting its agriculture industry, et cetera. So it does have this reputation. Is this a sign that we're seeing a change, at least in terms of with China?
Yes. I think, you know, you get quite a few analysts have been talking about one of the biggest geopolitical threats to the long-term dominance of the United States is some kind of European-Chinese partnership. At the moment, America absolutely dominates the world's economic system, and that gives them a huge amount of power, a huge amount of prosperity as well, and it's what enables America to borrow at such dramatically low interest rates. And the biggest thing that could undermine that the quickest would be if Europe pulled out from supporting the U.S. system and switched sides to China. And so quite a few analysts have talked for years about that being a possibility. I think there's a lot of people that just assume that this would never happen. They assume that Europe is firmly part of the kind of the liberal, free part of the world. Now, you look at these initiatives, there is still some friction between Europe and China. You know, there's headlines at the moment about possibly a steel war between the two, and that's kind of heating up with both blocs trying to protect their steel industry, for example, and a lot of other nations doing the same. But you look at this, you look at the way China is really trying to court Europe. It's quite different, I think, than what we just heard about with Jeremiah. They're not seeking to take advantage and just try and get... pursue policies that are going to harm Europe through trade in the same way that they are with Australia and New Zealand. Instead, they're looking to build a relationship to bring Europe around. And I think the big case here that should really wake a lot of people up that you've drawn a lot of attention to is the Asia Infrastructure and Investment Bank, where America was very firm. We don't want anyone to get behind this. This is a threat to us. And Europe sided with China over to America. And there are analysts warning that this could be a harbinger of things to come and has the potential to be very dangerous to America.
China, sounds like you're saying China is being, it's not just being opportunistic here. There's a little bit more long-term strategic planning going on. I think that's a very interesting angle that we need to keep on watching. Thank you for that, Richard. For those of you who are just joining us, you are listening to The Trumpet Hour. This is The Week in Review on KPCG.FM or 101.3 on the FM dial. In the second half, we've been talking about China. It's just astounding how fast China has been rising. I came across this statistic this week that shocked me. I think it might shock a few of our listeners. Don Cox, he's a very well-respected investor, a commodity investor and money manager in Canada. And he said this. He said that in 1979, there were less than 100 privately owned vehicles in China. He said the government owned fleets of vehicles, but in terms of privately owned vehicles, there were less than 100. Now, fast forward 36 years, China now has the largest middle class in the world. The Chinese are buying more vehicles than Americans. I mean, the rise of China has been absolutely astounding. All right, next up, we'll be looking at news from America. Andrew, Time Magazine had a very interesting cover this week in its latest edition. Tell us a bit about that.
Yes. Well, you may have heard, but the United States has a lot of debt. Like
the United States?
The United States.
The one that we are currently in here?
Yes.
This United States. Okay.
About $19 trillion worth of debt. Now, in all fairness, about $5 trillion of that the U.S. government owes to themselves, which basically means they just took it from the Social Security Fund. But still, that's $14 trillion that we owe either to foreign nations or to individual treasury holders here in America. So
that's a lot of coin.
It's a lot of coin.
Actually, it's probably no coin. It's just digital money.
Yeah, most of it. But so Time Magazine did a cover. The title's pretty catchy. It's The United States of Insolvency. And they actually, these are big numbers they throw around here. So he actually has one section where he breaks it down into terms that... Yeah. We can understand.
Yeah, when I see numbers trillions and billions and millions, it starts to get all confusing.
The average American family makes $54,000 a year. They said if that family had the same debt as the government, they'd be making $54,000 a year. They'd be spending $64,000 a year, $10,000 more than they have. And they'd already have about $223,000 on their credit card.
That's a lot of...
So, yeah, you can imagine if you... Well, MasterCard or Visa, I don't know what credit card you use, but they wouldn't let you do that. They wouldn't let you have $200,000 on your credit card when you only make $50,000 a year and you're already spending $10,000 more than you've got every single year.
Yeah, and why don't they do that?
Right. Right, because you go insolvent.
Right. Hence the title of the article.
Now, the U.S. government, they've got a little bit of a trick
up. But the U.S. government's different.
They've got a trick up their sleeve in that because they have a central bank, I mean, or Federal Reserve, they can just print money. Or actually, they used to print money. Now they just type on the keyboard and there's digital money.
Oh, so we're all saved.
But the tricky part is, I mean, but they're still reliant on, I mean, to have other nations have confidence in that, they have to keep still buying those treasury bonds. And we've got $14 trillion in debt in those treasury bonds. We spend about over $200 billion every year just on interest for those treasury bonds. And the only way we get away with that here in America is that the interest rate keeps going down. They said under the Obama administration, the national debt's almost doubled, but the interest rates halved. So the amount we're actually paying in interest is about the same as it was in 2007.
So we have way more debt.
So we got twice the amount of debt, but half.
What's saving us is
the
interest
rate.
Yep, the interest rate's lower. That's saving us.
He makes the point that if the interest rate went up to 4.8%, which, I mean, if you have a credit card, 4.8% would be great. But it said for the U.S. government, if the interest rate went up to 4.8%, which is what it was at in 2007. If, say, foreign nations, they didn't trust us to be able to repay and say, well, we want that 4.8% again, we'd be spending more money on interest than we would on our defense budget.
Incredible.
And actually, this is a few years ago, Niall Ferguson, one economic, he actually looked back at historical trends and said that that's actually a pretty reliable equation to figure out when empires collapse, like Rome or the Soviet Union, is when the cost of their interest is more than their cost of defense, things usually start falling apart. He, at the time, he predicted that that would happen this year in 2016.
Right.
It hasn't because the interest rate's half of what it used to be.
Right. But that's just if they go back to 4%. That doesn't seem very high to me, like historically speaking.
Right. And, well, that's only 2007. If you go back to like the 1990s or especially the 1970s, it was a lot higher than that.
Yeah, interest rates went up to 14%. What does that do to our budget then?
Right. Well, you'd
we have no budget.
You'd,
it goes
you'd
to
take
documents.
It. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I think you'd get to the point where all $3 trillion, whatever we collect in taxes each year, just goes to interest. But
absolutely incredible. America in a position that we could be spending more on interest payments than national defense. And if interest rates go even back to where they're normal, according to Time magazine there, America's in a lot of trouble. Okay, Andrew, thank you very much for that. Swinging back to the Middle East, Brent, there were some pretty terrible bombings that took place in Jerusalem. Didn't get a lot of international press. What happened?
Yes, on Monday afternoon, my wife and I were just in a store on the main street in the German colony, which is one of the southern suburbs of the capital of Israel, Jerusalem. And then the next suburb over is the suburb of Tel Piot. And while we were there, we noticed a couple of police cars buzzing past. We didn't really know what happened at the time. But again, we got back to our apartment and we checked online to see. Well, we noticed online that there had been a suicide bomber attack a bus or walk onto a bus, put the device between his legs just over where the bus's fuel is located and detonated the bomb. Now, this has got a lot of people in Israel scared and worried, especially this time of year when you've got people flooding into Jerusalem for the Passover season, which for them starts this evening. And the Jerusalem public transit system's already pretty overburdened, and there's people in buses. That's how they get around in Jerusalem mostly. So it's worrying them because they've had this experience before, back in from 2000 to 2005. I forget the numbers, but they're in the thousands of Israelis that were killed from suicide bombers going in the transit system, going on buses and letting themselves go off. And that hasn't happened in the past 10 years. And so Israelis are worried whether we're going to see a return to that style of intifada against them. And we've seen the knife attacks over the past 6 months. And while they are damaging, obviously, to your just how you feel when you walk around the streets, now you can't get on a bus again in fears of an explosion going off. Now, I don't know if this will get out of control like that. They have built the defensive wall that people think is enclosing in the West Bank or whatever. But that pretty much had stopped these getting explosives into Jerusalem to conduct these terrorist attacks. And yet somehow this explosive device was able to get in there, and somehow Hamas put it on this 19-year-old kid, and he walks onto a bus and explodes himself.
Nice peace partners over there, Hamas. Brent, I'm glad to hear that you guys are okay over there. Continue to stay safe. We know you will. Thank you for bringing us that report. You've been listening to Trumpet Hour, and we are nearing the end of our program. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there and receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. All these stories that we've been talking about today are there. You can find them. We'll finish this program with our lightning round. That's our rapid fire important news from around the world by our panelists. That's coming up next, but first, a quick break.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the week in review. It's time now for our lightning round. One last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention. Richard, start us off.
Here's a story that really got me quite annoyed. You may remember Anders Breivik. He was the one who, in 2011, killed 77 people in Norway using bombs and guns and grenades, etc. Well, a court in Oslo have ruled that his human rights have been violated. He complained that his isolation from other prisoners, his frequent strip searches, and the fact that he was often handcuffed during the early part of his imprisonment violated his human rights. The court has backed him and have ordered the government to pay his legal costs amounting to around $41,000. But it shows how Europe has to change if it's going to seriously deal with the threat of terrorism.
Okay. Thank you, Richard. Brent.
Iran this week conducted the first launch of a new rocket that the Pentagon views as a key element of their effort to build long-range missiles. The launch of the Simorgh space launch vehicle on Tuesday was judged by the U.S. intelligence agencies to be partly successful. It didn't reach orbit, but that means they don't know whether that was failed or they weren't planning to on this test. Now, this weapon is capable of holding the payload of 220 pounds, which would be to either put something in space that's going to orbit around the world, or it's going to be a nuclear device would be put on it. Now, Republican Mike Rogers from Alabama, he's commented on the launch saying, America's enemies know an opportunity when they see one. Our allies see that they're on their own. And the president proposed a nearly 10% reduction in missile defense compared to last year's budget request, that is this year. Then he goes on to say, what does he think? The Iranians have a Simorgh ICBM on the launch pad because the mullahs want to go to the moon? Obviously, that is not what they're wanting to do.
Good point. Okay, thank you very much, Andrew.
Yes, well, authorities in San Diego, California recently uncovered one of the longest drug smuggling tunnels between Mexico and the United States. The tunnel was 874 yards long and ran from an elevator shaft in Tijuana to a hole in the ground on the U.S. side next to what looked like a pallet business. Authorities discovered more than 2,000 pounds of cocaine and 14,000 pounds of marijuana in the tunnel.
Incredible. Okay, Jeremiah, bring us home.
Russian military engineers used robots and specially trained dogs to successfully clear the Syrian city of Palmyra of almost 3,000 explosives that were left there by the Islamic State. Altogether, the Russians cleared about 230 hectares of land, and it took about 3 weeks or so to do it. And the happiest part of this story is that, from what I could tell, they didn't lose a single robot or dog during this dangerous operation.
Hey, nice to end on a positive there. I'm Robert Morley, today's Trumpet Hour radio host, filling in for Joel Hilliker. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive your daily news, to cut out the clutter, and to find out what is really important. Send your questions to letters@thetrumpet.com. Go ahead and follow us on Twitter @thetrumpet_com. Find us on Facebook and Google+. Just search Philadelphia Trumpet. Thank you very much today, gentlemen, for joining the program. A big thanks to Richard, Brent, Jeremiah, and Andrew.
Great to be with you.
No problem. It's
a pleasure. Great to be here.
And also thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondo. I'll leave you with some words from Bill Gross, one of the more influential, if not the most influential bond trader alive today. He described America's economic situation this way. He said, the Romans gave their plebeian citizens a day at the Colosseum, and the French royalty gave the bourgeoisie a piece of figurative cake. So it may be true to form that in the still prosperous developed economies of 2016, we provide fantasy sports, cell phone game apps, sexting, and fast food to appease the masses, keep them occupied and distracted at all costs. Listeners, don't be distracted. Join us next week as we make sense of this increasingly crazy world. Thank you for joining us today on Trumpet Hour. I hope you've enjoyed it. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.